This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
But it seems to be how their brains work. Let's watch another piece of this. Actually, we're going to go into some of these voicemails here that were played in court the other day and some of the text messages. And we'll kind of work our way through this. I want to take pay a lot of attention here to the tone of what she's saying, how she's saying it, and more importantly, who she's saying it to. Because on the surface, she's leaving a voicemail for John O'Keefe. She's texting John O'Keefe. So one would assume these are for John O'Keefe. I don't know that that's truly the reality of this. Let's take a look and we'll work our way through.
John, I fucking hate you! John, I'm dealing with your fucking kids. Nobody knows where the fuck you are, you fucking pervert.
Okay, I want to stop there for those two. The first one, those are two separate voicemails. John, I effing hate you. Why does she hate him? Let's just play by reality here of what we know, of what she knew at the time. He didn't look mortally wounded. She left him in the yard. She saw him either in the yard or in the street. I'm not even going to the house story because it's BS. She's already said where she last saw him. Didn't look mortally wounded. And she hates him. Because what, Jen McCabe said that there's a lady down the road that you used to be in a relationship with, which she knew about. Or is she mad at John O'Keefe because John O'Keefe got in her way? Because now she's over here and her reality is this. She has this image that she projects and everybody likes her and Karen's good. Karen's lovely. And then if the reality over here of what happened is going to conflict with her version of herself that she likes other people to see, being the woman who killed the guy that's a saint that everybody loves, and he just took in his niece and nephew and is being a good dad, and she's responsible for injuring or even worse, killing him? Why does she hate him? Because, well, he was in the way, and that's really going to make her look bad. That's how I take the vile I hate you. Not even just that she's thinking he's sleeping with somebody, but because of what just took place. That voicemail was literally would have been minutes after that strike would have taken place. Why the hate? Why not? Oh my God, I get your wits about yourself and try to help him. But I hate you. I effing hate you.
I think it's an astute interpretation. What other, you know, earth-shattering event happened before this that caused some chasm between Karen Reed and John O'Keefe that would result in her leaving a voicemail saying she hates him? We don't have any evidence that, you know, there was, you know, something like John O'Keefe cheated that day or something, and we have evidence of that, or that he said he's breaking up with her, nothing like that. However, one event that could explain it is Karen Reed, you know, hitting John O'Keefe and kind of realizing, oh, my facade that I put out to the world, to these people, is going to come crashing down now. And I hate you for that because you're the cause of that, not me.
That's what seems to make a lot more sense in this. And of course, when we're talking about cheating, the only person who's talked about cheating is Karen Reed. Karen Reed's the one inviting his buddy over for a sleepover. It's like a little projection there. And she goes right to the second one. You're an effing pervert. You're an effing pervert. So it seems like there's some rationalization going on there because he didn't look mortally wounded. He's not answering any of her calls because she's already called him a gazillion times and there's no answer. Oh God, there's this realization that maybe she did hurt him. Or, no, he must have gone down to the girl's house. Maybe he's sleeping with her right now. He's a pervert. And she's trying to rationalize and find some way for her mind to process this because reality ain't working out too well. Let's continue with the rest.
The defendant texts John O'Keefe, your kids are cucking alone at 1:02 a.m. on the 29th.
Hate when those kids are cucking alone. That's you don't want your kids to be cucking. That's
certainly not
good.
Defendant texts John O'Keefe, I'm back in Mansfield. The kids are home alone. 1:04:14 a.m.
So this is just straight up manipulation at this point. She's the kids are not home alone. She's not back in Mansfield. She's at the house with the kids steaming over all of this. So again, if someone is genuinely concerned for the well-being of the other person and you're concerned for the right reasons, I think she's concerned, but it's not for the right reasons. It's not, is John okay so he can continue living his life? It's, is John not okay because this is really going to mess up mine? That's what I'm
feeling. Yeah, I feel you. And it's... you know, there's been a lot of issues with Karen Reed's character. And now the jury can't convict her just based on a bad character.
No.
But jurors are human beings, and they're going to draw inferences from these texts. Perhaps it's going to ring in their memory. Hey, I remember a person who's like that. Well, yeah. I like that person. And so the complexion of the case and of how the jury is viewing Karen Reed vis-a-vis these texts is a problem for the defense.
It just keeps reinforcing a very not likable human being. Let's keep watching. We're listening here.
Yes, 1 in the morning. I'm with your fucking niece and nephew. You fucking pervert. You're a fucking pervert.
Is that one getting a little more... I can hear some franticness here. I'm with your effing kids, because every loving partner likes to refer to the other's kids as your effing kids. Not, John, I'm here. We're really worried about you. I'm going to take care of the kids. I'm here. I'm not going to leave them. We just need to know where you're at. No, I'm going to abandon the kids. I'm going to go back to my house because there's something far more important at my house that I need to drive through a blizzard at, rather than stay with the minors that you supposedly care about, that you're getting so close to, Karen, because that's your other story, which I'm sure is complete BS. And yes, I'm going to abandon them and go there because you're an effing pervert. But she's still there. And she continues with this dandy.
John, I'm going home. I cannot babysit your niece. I need to go home. You are fucking using me right now. You're fucking another girl.
Okay, that right there. You are effing using me right now. You are effing another girl. The tone. The tone is what I think is really important there to recognize. And I go, none of this can be, you know, there's not, you know, body language experts here or vocal recognition. People are going to take this into court and go, listen to her tone. But... because it doesn't prove anything technically, but it kind of does. That's a reassurance. That's a, you're effing another girl. You're doing, you know, everything she's saying is self-assurance in that tone. It's not, you're effing another girl anymore. It's, this is what's happening. This is what's going on. She's telling herself this. She's not telling him this. She's telling her. And why would you be telling that you're doing this? You're doing that. It would be, are you doing this? Why are you doing this? It's not, you're doing this. She's self-affirmed. She's soothing herself with these stories in this call is what is happening. There's more to it.
And you would think that an innocent person would have a completely different presentation, that if they would be concerned about this individual and not sort of, you know, drawing up in their minds what fits their own narrative of what makes them feel comfortable with the situation.
This whole thing is about fitting her own narrative, even in the chaos of it all. If she was genuinely concerned that there was something wrong with him and it wasn't just about her, she'd be at that scene trying to revive him, trying to get him help, putting her own emotions to the side of however wronged she felt, however justified she feels in whatever behavior she took. But no, she goes back to the house, stays there, shames him, threatens or says that she's abandoned his children and can't get a hold of him and leaves these crazy voicemails all night. That's not someone who's genuinely concerned. That's someone who's hoping that maybe these will be looked at as I'm a victim over here and something happened to him and they'll never have enough evidence to tie it to me. Oh, wait, my taillight's broken. Like, oh, and there's that. And there's a little more to the audio.
You fucking loser. Fuck yourself.
Oh, and by the way, for good measure, as any good partner would do, that partner with kids, she's doing all of this supposedly lying in bed next to the kids. So she's literally next to the child saying, you're an effing loser, you're effing someone else, and every other horrible thing she said next to the child. Do we need to know any more about this woman before we just go guilty by default? And I know you can't put somebody, you know, but the thing is, and again, I go back to some of this where, you know, is she factually innocent? I think that's slipping away fast, but I think there's still maybe some room for that, meaning not innocent by did she do it, but can you prove that she did it? A jury hears this stuff, and people are people. You can't convict somebody on emotions or being a bad person, but sometimes they do. And this, I think, could push anyone over the edge if you're kind of on the fence. And most of the jurors are like, yeah, she did it. She's guilty of second degree murder. The consciousness of guilt here seems to be off the charts.
You look at those statements, and then you couple that with some statements that Kara Reid made, essentially mocking John O'Keefe's mother.
Yeah.
The day after, when she's talking about John O'Keefe being dead, and she's making these statements, you know, not to a good buddy in private, to like ABC or something. It's a publicized interview. You take all of those things together, and you really, the jury is going to get a bad impression as to her character and whether she's capable of doing something like this.
Yeah, I mean, that I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm seeing if I can pull it up here really quick. Yeah. So just for a piece of context here for a second, I want to say,
and
Jen McCabe is talking about going back to the house or going to John's house, spending time with John's family as they're grieving and they're trying to put this stuff together, spending hours there. She doesn't know how many hours she spent there, but it was many hours with that family because she was a friend and she cared about her friend. Karen shows up like a girlfriend who just had her boyfriend break up with her to go get her stuff out of the room. Has to get her stuff that day. I don't know what she's getting. Like, go get your hair dryer, or like what, you know, that, you know, like the stuff that usually is exchanged in moments like that. She's treating it like a breakup, not a potential homicide that she's responsible for. She's got to go get her stuff. And this is how she described that moment.
And his mother leans over the kitchen island and says to me, "I think he looks like he got hit by a car. He looks like he got hit by a car." I'm like, wait a minute. Were you both looking at the same body?
His mother, how dare that bitch? Her son just died. She looks over me and says, "It looks like he got hit by a car. I mean, he was, you know, by the road and there was taillight pieces and he was injured." Like, how dare her for thinking he got hit by a car, considering that's exactly what the police are thinking right now, too. And they're kind of treating it like a hit and run. And I happen to be the vehicle with a broken taillight. How dare her think that?
And how oblivious to the emotional reality of this victim's family. And then to present it in such a fashion on national TV, that's one thing that's been a common theme, is her aloofness, her callousness, and those things are going to be strikes against her.
Yeah, and there's still a lot more to come. I wanted to ask you this, because the first trial, you know, it really, they worked it in reverse and they tried to basically counter everything the defense was going to try and throw out there with Proctor and everything right in the first round. They did not paint this picture like they're doing it right now very well. It feels like by the time Proctor will take the stand, when the defense gets their hands on him, I think people might relate to Proctor. and I'm not excusing his language about women or anything like that. I think that's certainly not my choice of words I would use. I don't speak like that. I know some guys do. Not in any way an excuse, but there are men that do speak like that. But take the, you know, the derogatory things about being female out of it and just put in there that basically his feelings of her being a bad person, being a shitty human being, basically. By the time the jury hears some of this, and by the way, Proctor owns it all. He's not saying, "I didn't say that. What's the model of phone you heard this on?" You know, and like, could this be altered? Like, they're questioning even the vials of blood and how that was stored over here. He's owning it. I shouldn't have said that. That was not okay. It was a poor choice of words. He's owning it. Karen's owning nothing. So he's coming across as, yeah, totally stupid, should not have said that. But a jury can look at them and go, yeah, I get, not a good choice of words, but I get why you don't like her. I get why you feel that way as a human being, especially if you know if your buddies, if John's been saying, you know, I really got to get into this relationship, which he had been saying to several people, not directly to Proctor, but they all talk. And if his buddies are going, yeah, you got to hear what this woman was like. And from his own stories, I understand how the people on that department would be kind of like, yeah, she's going down. Not because they need to seal the deal for her, but because they know the type of person she is. And when you're mad that your buddy just got killed and the person who likely did it had been this type of a person to him for 2 years and he had finally had enough, and look how tragically this ended and where all the evidence points to, yeah, you're going to be like, yeah, bitch is going down. That's not a crazy thing to say if you know the background and the personality of someone. If you don't, that's inappropriate. But the thing is, they did.
Tony, I've been saying this for a while now. In the first trial, the defense kind of had an apparent moral high ground because you had Truman Proctor. He's making these shady statements. Sounds like a jerk, that kind of thing. And so the prosecution looks shady. In the second go-around, we have some shadiness on behalf of Karen Reed, some callousness and some really distasteful statements and actions. And so the prosecution is sort of leveled that moral high ground, and advantage is no longer to the defense on that issue.
I think they've obliterated the high ground. I feel like Proctor is actually going to be a benefit for the prosecution. I feel like people are going to look at some of these things and the way they're going to try and poke holes in them and the language, and they're going to go, kind of get it. Again, not sticking up for him. A very unprofessional human being in the way that he was speaking like this and talking about the case he was. But if you're just looking at the human aspect of it, and you knew that this type of person, and you knew this personality was the type of person that your good friend or buddy or a buddy of your buddies was being subjected to. Yeah. Or take it the other way around. If you're a woman and the guy is treating you that way, take the case out of it. And you're hearing all these stories. I'm sure there's a lot of, he's an asshole. He's a dick. He's a this, he's a that, he's a whatever for treating you that way. It's human nature to feel that way, to stand up for the people that you care about. And that, I think, is what you have here. I don't think it's a grand conspiracy to frame Karen Reed. I don't even think that after seeing how they were gathering the evidence, now that that's been really cleared up in a very clear timeline, that there was taillight planted. I was kind of thinking maybe they're kind of tipping the scales. But once you kind of learn, okay, it was people are trampling all over this ground. It gets icy once the trampling is done and more snow comes on top of it in a record nor'easter. You get to that bottom level, it's ice. You're not going to see the ground where that taillight would have been. So of course it took all those days later to get to it because it had to melt. Unless you took a flamethrower to the yard, you wouldn't be getting to it. And then you'd be damaging the evidence. So yes, under the ice, it had to melt. That's what makes actual sense. So I don't know.
Yeah, there was certainly, difficult circumstances with this huge blizzard, and that's going to affect evidence collection. And there might be some issues that arise as a result of that. I think the prosecution has done a good job kind of explaining to the jury, hey, it's not all this smoke and mirror shady stuff. These were just kind of the elements. This is what we had to do. We did the best we could.
It for an analogy, the first one that's like the 4th of July. And you get your fireworks like on the 2nd. You're like, you're so excited on the 3rd. I'm gonna put off just a few fireworks. Cut them all off. Then you end up doing most of them. And then by the 4th, when it's the big trial, it's the 2nd, you got a couple smoke bombs left. And that seems to be all they're playing with.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.